Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Physicians for Healthy Communities, a physician-led organization that educates on the science of prevention to improve public health. Visit their website to learn how they prevent substance misuse while supporting individuals, families, and communities. Go to physiciansforhealthycommunities.org. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for a neuroplastic conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Neuroplastic, as in the ability of the brain and nervous system to change structure and function. It's generally known that the brain continues to grow until the mid-20s. The political age of being an adult is 21, but the scientific brain age is 25 or 27. The brain grows in different ways, myelination and synaptic pruning. Myelination is the coating on the neurons, the cells of the brain. Like electric wires, when having coating on those wires, information passes much faster. The electricity flows much faster with coating. And similarly, when neurons have myelin, the coating for the neurons, or electric wires of the brain, the information goes much faster. And the last part of the brain to get myelin is the frontal lobe, the executive decision-making part of the brain. The second way the brain grows is through synaptic pruning. During adolescence, the final growth spurt of the brain has important decisions to make. The brain decides which neuronal pathways it will keep and which to prune or cut away. If you use your brain for art, music, sports, and language, then those pathways will get stronger. If you use your brain for drugs or even talking unkindly to yourself, then those pathways get stronger. The brain has neuroplasticity. It can change based on what it is exposed to, especially as the brain is growing. To learn more about neuroplasticity, I reach out to Dr. Kristen Gilliland. Dr. Kristen Gilliland delivered a TEDx presentation titled Rewiring Revolution, Neuroplasticity's Impact on Well-Being. She then developed an award-winning educational documentary titled Speaking Through Me, focused on the growing brain and effect of stress, marijuana, and fentanyl. Dr. Gilliland has a PhD in organic chemistry and taught classes on chemistry of drugs and poisoning. Her son Anders developed cannabis-induced psychosis and later died of a drug overdose. She turned pain into purpose by educating others on the brain. To learn more about Dr. Kristen Gilliland, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Kristen Gilliland, welcome to High Truths.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
No, I'm excited. I saw you present at the National RX Summit and then at the Western State Summit. And I said, I have to meet this lady in person of all the wonderful things that you're doing.
Well, I think it's right back at you. So,
yeah. And you're one of the there are many parents who've taken their pain, turned it into purpose. But you have the added benefit of being an organic chemist and professor of chemistry. So tell us about your career and how chemistry and turned into research on schizophrenia and what you do.
I'd love to. I was an associate professor at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in California. And there I taught organic chemistry, but I also, one of my passions was neurochemistry. And even when I was an undergraduate in biochemistry, and I took all those courses that I could that had to do with anything neuro, because I just was fascinated by them. And so I decided to couple organic chemistry with I would say neurochemistry in the way of teaching people the biosynthesis of neurotransmitters and, you know, how they're broken down and using that. And so I started this course that grew and it was wonderful. And also coupled with a course in the chemistry of drugs and poisons, because I was, again, very fascinated with how the mechanism of actions of substances on the brain. And those courses kind of led me into wanting to do some research and into neurochemistry or neuroscience. And the other thing that led me there was my son had developed schizophrenia, which firmly believed that it was cannabis-induced schizophrenia. And so I came to the Warren Center here at Vanderbilt University. So it's the Warren Center for Neuroscience Drug Discovery to research new pharmaceutical treatments for schizophrenia, because my son was not compliant with his medication because he didn't like the way it made him feel. And so I came here to try and find new treatments, because they were doing very novel approaches to finding new antipsychotics.
Interesting. And well, there's so much thing there. Interesting. What is your class that you had about, you know, chemistry of drugs in the brain? How did students, you were talking to college students, how did they react to that? I remember I actually was a chemistry major. I don't want to say that because you expect me like remember how all these bonds work, and I don't remember. But I was a chemistry major, and I remember there were students who were like, oh, yeah, we could make all these drugs. I'm wondering how that interaction was on a college level.
It was quite interesting and entertaining, I will say, because, you know, the kids who would come in, and I call them kids because I'm a lot older than they are.
We're allowed.
But when they would come in, and a lot of them had their own personal reasons for being there. You know, some of them wanted to go into medicine or, you know, into some area in neuroscience in graduate school, whatever it might be. But a lot of them it was for their own curious reasons. And they would never ask things publicly during the classroom, but afterwards would come up to me and ask me questions about specific substances that they may have used at some point of their life and wondered the impact of that on their brain. And but it was a very popular class, and the number of kids that would be in there, all different varieties, as I said, and they loved it. And just to be able to learn how, you know, certain things from even alcohol, right? From even understanding alcohol to psychedelics, what we know so far, it was fascinating to them and to me as well.
Did they understand the risk, or was it more like, oh, well, I can try this?
No, I actually would go into both. I would go into both the dangers. I would talk about if things were addictive. We talked about addiction. So I would give them everything. And I'd say, your prefrontal cortex is getting very close to being fully developed. You can make educated decisions. So I'm going to give you the risks associated with taking these substances, and hopefully you'll use your prefrontal cortex wisely.
Nice. Use your prefrontal cortex wisely. I like that. That's a good little motto. If you don't mind, can you tell us a little bit more about your son, Anders, and what happened to him?
I would love to. During middle school, started to show a lot of symptoms of anxiety. He actually is a twin, and his twin was the complete opposite of him. His twin was very popular as far as going out and could easily meet new people and talk with people. Anders was very much more introverted. Yeah, so I say his twin was extroverted, right? And he was very introverted. And it led to some difficulties with him making friends. And as he moved into high school, he met a group of people who started experimenting with marijuana or weed. So they started experimenting, and we started to notice that when he would come home, there was a certain smell, you know, that you could tell. And so trying to talk to him about that and saying, you know, this is not good. And the one thing I will say,
is this when marijuana was legal? Is it in California?
This was when it was medicinal. So it actually, for medicinal purposes, that was 1996 is when it became legalized for medicinal purposes. Recreation was 2016, I believe. So this is when it was still used for medicinal purposes. However, all the kids knew how to get it. You know, they all knew ways to get it.
Did he call it his medicine?
He said it helped with his anxiety. You know, it helped him with his anxiety. But we started to notice that he began to use more. And by the time he actually had graduated from high school, shortly after that, he began to hear voices and he began to talk to people who weren't there and started developing this pattern of he would be up for days. And then he would just come into this very dark place, and he a lot of hostility towards himself. And we took him to see a psychiatrist. And at that time, because he was under the age of 18, we could go with him and talk to the psychiatrist. And he had diagnosed him with schizoaffective disorder. And
I'm wondering if that's the right diagnosis, because I see a lot of psychiatrists do this, but if you look at the DSM-5 criteria to call someone schizophrenia, you have to exclude drugs.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he has cannabis-induced psychosis. And that difference in the diagnosis is important, because if you catch it early and you stop using marijuana, then it could potentially be reversible instead of labeling someone of schizophrenia and then that's a lifetime sentence.
I absolutely agree with you there. And I think it was, and you know, we brought him to one psychiatrist at the time, and he was put on antipsychotics, and he, like I said, for him, he was a very creative person and musical, created a lot of music. And we know that with schizophrenia, there are three, you know, the symptom clusters is the positive symptoms, the hallucinations, delusions, and the negative symptoms, kind of the anhedonia and, you know, apathy and cognitive, just disorganized thoughts, all those types of things. He definitely had all of those symptoms. And when he took the antipsychotics, he still felt just flat. You know what I mean? Like he those other symptoms, the negative symptoms and the cognitive symptoms, he didn't like, and he didn't want to make music anymore. He didn't want to do his art anymore. Mm-hmm. And he isolated himself and he went off his medication. And what happened is that the way he dealt with it was getting into other substances as trying to deal with everything that was going on. And he began to use Xanax, codeine, cough syrup, you know, he would find, and then started getting into cocaine and heroin. So I came in 2018 to the Warren Center here to research new treatments for schizophrenia, because I couldn't reach him. No matter what I tried, whether it was for, you know, the schizophrenia or whether it was for addiction, because he started to become addicted, and the number of times of talking to him, trying to get him to go to rehab, he was having, you know, nothing to do with it. And the only thing I knew how to do as a mother was to put my science to work and try to come up with new treatments, find new pharmaceutical treatments. And that's what here is what we do is try at the Warren Center, we try and find new treatments for schizophrenia that really deal with the cognitive and the negative aspects to help keep people on their medicines.
Now, Warren Center, that's in Vanderbilt?
Yes, it's part of Vanderbilt Medical School.
Did you leave California then?
Well, I went on sabbatical. So I went here on sabbatical and, you know, planning to return. And within 6 months after I was here, my son died from an accidental overdose. And I was at work and the police came to my work to tell me that he had died. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot there, and I always get emotional, but, In fact, I have his socks on that he wore when he died today. Aww. Because I feel they're my superpowers, and they're unmatching, and they have holes in them, and they're. But it always gives me that superpower of, you know, he's with me.
Was he poisoned? Did he take like a Xanax?
It wasn't fentanyl. It was actually. Well, I shouldn't say that. That. He was doing a lot of cocaine and heroin, and I was able to see that from his phone when we got his phone and looking what he was getting from dealers. But he actually died from methamphetamine. So I think what happened is that they, which he never asked, like looking through his phone, there was never him wanting to get methamphetamine. But I believe that's actually was the cause of death. Was they said it was polysubstance, accidental. But it probably was the methamphetamine that he may have thought was cocaine.
Yeah.
When he took it, and it obviously when that happened, it took a long time to get back on my feet. And he has a twin brother who's definitely it's been really hard on him, really really hard on him. And I have came here, and I couldn't go back then, because what I was working on first just with schizophrenia, I could go back and educate, but I was like, I need to be here now. And it was difficult. It was difficult to go back to where he was. And so I stayed at Vanderbilt, and they gave me a position here, and I still worked on in the lab finding, you know, coming up with new pharmaceutical potential compounds for schizophrenia. But then the executive director of the center asked me, because he knew I was an educator, and said, how would you feel about becoming the director of outreach and advocacy here? And he said, you know, if you feel strong enough, telling your son's story and educating. And I just said, yes, it's exactly what I want to do.
That's meant for you.
Yes. And, you know, just with everything, my educational background, and just, I love teaching. I absolutely love teaching. And now I get to inspire youth, you know, I get to inspire youth and tell them about the dangers of cannabis, which to me, I just spoke at the Smart Approaches to Marijuana conference that they had.
I just missed you.
Oh, yeah. Were you at CADCA?
I was at CADCA. And okay. My talk is about the death diaries, but I include more marijuana talk. But yes. Yeah.
Oh well, I'm bummed. I was just bummed that I missed you. I go and I speak to kids, and you know, it's about all drug. It's really teaching them about their brain and development and how critical the time is, and the impact of both stress and substance use on that development, just because of the increased plasticity they have. But particularly in the sense of marijuana, teaching them about the endocannabinoid system, you know, and why it is. And I think that's one thing that I have learned from going out and talking to kids, which I've been doing now, is that it seems like it's an advanced level to speak to these kids, but they love it. They actually, it's what I hear the most from the counselors or teachers from the feedback is that they say, I love the fact that she did not talk down to us. And she, you know, assumes that we can get this. And of course I make it, you know, palatable, but that's one of my areas that I love to do, is to try and take those subjects and make them, you know, understandable to whether I'm talking to fifth graders or 12th graders or adults.
Yeah.
And it's something that I truly enjoy and get, I feel like I'm honoring my son in that.
You are. Let's talk a little bit more about marijuana, cannabis-induced psychosis. In your own family, does addiction run in the family? Does schizophrenia run in the family? If not, we could, you know, say that your son had cannabis-induced psychosis that then converted to schizophrenia with continued use.
Right. Well, we do have a history of addiction in our family. And actually it was on both sides of the family, my side and their father's side. And so this is the way I was very just no, you, I mean, just it's like they've got the genetic, you know, sunk, they're sunk when it would come to that. And yeah. And but as far as schizophrenia, I don't know of anybody in the family. There's nobody on either side of the family who suffered with schizophrenia. And I don't know, but I do know one thing, and that my son had mentioned that when he used marijuana, that he had had psychotic breaks, kind of things. He would tell me that he had psychotic breaks. And we know now that, you know, if that happens, the more you use, the more you're increasing right. your risk of developing the disorder.
I think Anders is an example of someone who, if we targeted, if I could do like one public health thing, is if I targeted men between the ages of 20 and 30 and prevented them from using marijuana or getting a cannabis use disorder, we could decrease 30% of all the schizophrenia in our country. And that's based on a study from Denmark with 7 million people. I think my role is to reach out to psychiatrists, because there's a reluctancy to make this diagnosis because it's like, oh, it's just weed. But by doing that, you're robbing an opportunity for a young person to recover. And instead, if they continue using, then they're locked in to a life of schizophrenia, which, as you've experienced, is no fun or very painful. So I think we need to do more to make that diagnosis in order to prevent schizophrenia and even target, again, like especially men, young boys between the ages of 20 and 30.
Well, and I think that when we look at the endocannabinoid, you know, the endogenous system that we have, and we think about the role of those endocannabinoids is for, regulating the release of neurotransmitters and synaptic plasticity. And when you think about that fact of flooding a system with THC instead of the brain saying, oh, we need to stop, you know, this neurotransmitter from being released right now, or we need to increase that. And then THC just comes in and overwrites that system, you know, or overrides it. It just needs to be out there, and people need to understand why. And that when we, you know, and I don't know, and I may be naive in this, but when we look at schizophrenia and some of the research that's been done, there's the theory of aberrant synaptic pruning that happens, you know, and they think that that has something to do with that. And when we look at, definitely we look at THC binding to those, the places where the endogenous, you know, cannabinoids, anandamide or 2-AG would bind and regulate the release of a neurotransmitter, which could and somehow result in pruning. I can't help but think that there is a correlation somehow. I don't want to state that and, you know, be completely wrong in my scientific hypothesis, but I think that that's, it suggests a lot.
It's interesting listening to a scientist who says flooding THC kind of screws up your and floods your endocannabinoid system. And yet if you look at the marijuana industry, it's like, well, you have natural endocannabinoids, so marijuana is healthy. Like the exact opposite of what the scientist says.
Well, and I always say if you have THC versus the endocannabinoid coming in, THC, if they're, you know, trying to get the same parking spot, THC is going to win every single time. Every single time.
I like that parking spot. You are a good teacher. I love that.
Yeah. So this message, as you said, it needs to be out there, and we need parents to understand. The number of parents that I've spoken to who have no idea, they have no idea. And even with Delta 8 and Delta 10, I'm in Tennessee where that is, you know, 21 and over, they can get, and kids get all the time. But that is, besides it messing with the brain.
It's maddening that we live in a country that, you know, wants labels and consumer protection, and yet we're selling these products that have never been tested in rats, not even rats. They're being tested on our children.
Right. And the fact that these people who are making them are like kitchen chemists who have, a lot of them have no idea. They don't test for any impurities.
Right.
You know, they just, they've gotten probably the protocol off the web or somewhere and are making it from CBD. And it's like, it's, that's one of the big messages here that I talk to kids in Tennessee, and they just think again, because they're selling it at these head shops or, you know, gas stations, that it's completely safe. And that it has been, you know, tested by the FDA or that they,
right.
And these messages need to get out to parents.
I think the messaging is important, but I think our government has failed us in lack of regulation by allowing these high potency products. If we look at pediatric poisoning, all the kids, the number one cause of kids under the age of five, these are not kids who have an addiction. They got into mom or dad's stash. And all the adults that are being poisoned, that we're not, you know, with other things in our society, with food, we have a way of protecting the public. And with this, we're just letting it go.
I agree 100%. And I agree that, you know, why not have a regulation on the percent THC if you're going to make it legal? Why not we say, you know, 10%? Because, I mean, I think anything above 10%, I consider high potency. And getting it out there. I mean, if they're going to legalize it, they should regulate it.
Yeah. And it's not just you're saying that 10% is high potency. These are huge studies out of Europe where marijuana has been legal in places like Amsterdam, London, Paris. And their definition of high potency was 10%. So, right. In America, that'd be low potency.
Well, it's funny because the NIH says 15%. Because I remember I looked up and they said 15% and above. And I think I was like, no, I would say 10%.
They just kind of pulled that out of the hat.
Yeah.
But are they losing credibility because of the letter recently sent from the Department of Health and Human Services saying marijuana should be, you know, rescheduled from 1 to 3 without at all.
Yes.
Considering that the product today is not at all the marijuana of the 1970s, and completely disregarding the high potency and the waxes and the dabs that are out there.
Right. I totally agree that in that sense, it's honestly infuriating to me that they would even consider that, and that that's where it's headed. I mean, I believe that's where it's headed. And yes, we're sending the wrong message. To everyone, to everybody. Yeah.
But it's more than the wrong message. I think it degrades our profession as scientists,
mm-hmm.
right? And as physicians, like you're calling something a medicine. For me as a doctor, like, wait, I have to go through all these hoops to be able to prescribe an antibiotic mm-hmm. or an aspirin. And yet you're calling everything else a medicine.
I think that if you go to... some of the dispensaries that they have these people that are like the cannabis doctors that
yeah.
talk about, oh, this one will help your anxiety or this one will help, you know, which puts that in the same category as
right,
a scientist.
Right. I know. Like my daughters have been to medical school, which was, you know, no picnic, 8 years of education versus 8 minutes of education yeah. as a punter, like, yeah. hey, take some of this. Neuroplasticity, that's kind of your thing. You did like a whole TED talk on that. And explain to us a little bit about how that neuroplasticity works in terms of drugs and addiction and growth.
Well, when we look at just especially the adolescent brain, I'm going to take for example, neuroplasticity is really the ability to rewire the communication in our brain and to rewire, you know, through connections. And basically, if we have nerve cells or neurons that talk to each other and communicate and say, yes, you know, the one neuron that's sending a signal to the next one and says, okay, send this message, keep it going, like telephone, you know, keep that going. Versus it might say, okay, we need to stop this signal, so we're going to stop it. And then they'll have no communication. Well, neuroplasticity is really just increasing the communication, and it's through surface area of the neurons, basically is what it is. We're kind of increasing connections between them. And the more that they talk to each other, it's just like if you think about having your best friend, you know, you start with someone and you know, especially I always say with kids, you start in school, you meet a new person, and then you're like, oh, I really like this person. So you just keep communicating and communicating and communicating, and your communication just gets stronger and stronger, you know, whatever it might be. You're talking to each other, texting each other, hanging out together all the time. The same is true with your neurons. You know, I mean, the more that they are interacting or communicating with each other, you are forming those connections. And when we look at the plasticity of the brain, especially in the reward circuitry. So when we look at which a lot of people know, dopamine, kind of are linked with motivation and pursuit and reward. If we look at the dopamine system, and during adolescence, we have this increased plasticity. So the brain is very, very plastic. And this is the time period in their life that they truly have the superpower to make healthy brain connections, to make them, and to also make unhealthy brain connections. When they have this increased plasticity in their brain, when we're looking at the reward circuitry, which is the dopamine reward system, that means that they also have that increased plasticity to more easily become addicted to things, right? Because if they're constantly using something, those neurons in that reward circuitry are talking to each other, keep that and strengthen that communication, then they are increasing the risk of becoming addicted to something. And, you know, you can't become addicted to something that you've never tried before. I mean, if you really think about it. And so trying to teach kids about prevention and how that increased plasticity that they have can make them more prone to addiction, and really just trying to give them that information so that they can make educated decisions, and to teach them when they do make those educated decisions, which is hard during their age, because that emotion, it's part of the emotional center in their brain, is where that reward center is. And it's heightened, right? It's heightened during that time period, and their prefrontal cortex is not fully online. So the prefrontal cortex is going to be like, okay, when you think about a risk, they're getting more bang for their buck during that time period, you know, mm-hmm. And that prefrontal cortex actually has to try and say, oh, wait, let me think logically here for a second. But when it's not fully online, it's more difficult to deal with those scenarios, peer pressure, things like that, because risk-taking is real. It's real, you know, during adolescence. And finding ways to talk to kids about this, to teach them that there's a biological reason for them wanting to take those risks. You know, I mean, it's trying to leave the nest and trying to spread their wings and do those things. But mainly coming down and teaching them that, yes, you have this neuroplasticity, or enhanced neuroplasticity during this time period, which will slow down a lot after you turn 25. So now's the time to make those connections, have those neurons talk to each other to form healthy connections. And just know that the choices you make can influence how your brain wires. And that's where we say neurons that fire together, wire together. That's the you know, the classic the classic saying. So really just trying to teach them.
Say that one more time. The neurons that
fire together, wire together.
Wire together.
Yes.
And that means that
what you're doing is you are enhancing that communication. And that also says a lot about synaptic pruning, because during this time period in their, you know, during adolescence, the brain is trying to, you know, make it, or I should say that the brain is becoming more efficient for them. And so connections or communication that is not used, you know, things that they may have done when they were a kid and they're not doing anymore, the brain says, oh, we're not using that. We don't need that, you know, connection. Let's get rid of it. So let's snip it.
Right.
Well, if kids are using a lot and they have the plasticity that's reinforcing that communication, the brain's going to say, well, we don't want to get rid of that because it's being used a lot, you know, thinking about it in that sense too. Just a very oversimplified, right? Very, very oversimplified. But trying to have to empower kids with the knowledge of understanding that, and that they truly, it's everything's a choice. Everything is a choice. And those choices, when they keep making that same choice over and over and over, even how they speak to themselves, you know, how they're treating themselves, how they're speaking to themselves.
Yes.
That wiring is stronger, and we call it long-term potentiation is really what it's called. But thinking about that they're actually increasing that communication, which is strengthening those neurons, strengthening the communication between them, which is basically like, you know, taking an overpass instead of going like the long way on a highway. All of a sudden, if there's a shortcut over the overpass, it's going to like, you know, and they just keep taking that over and over. And that's the brain will get just stuck in that overpass loop.
I like that. I also I have presentations and I talk about synaptic pruning and myelination and explain that that's how the brain grows. And my analogy is just like use it or lose it. If you're going to use it to learn, you know, math or art or music, those roads in your brain are going to be stronger, bigger freeways. And if you're not, then that gets, just like you said, snipped away, cut away.
Yeah. And that's exactly. And in fact, in the documentary, that's what we say, use it or lose it, because it is true. And can you imagine if we were taught that during, you know, being that age of being from 10, you know, 10 on, if you were taught real time about what was happening in your brain and you think, why don't we do that? Why, you know,
we need to do that. And I love how you add not just drugs, but also how you talk to yourself. Like, I'm mm-hmm. stupid, you know, like,
yes,
right. Oh, I'm not good. You know what I mean? Because then that, like you explained, then that becomes prominent right. in your brain.
Yeah. It becomes your internal dialogue, right? That you keep telling yourself over and over. And I think that that's something that all of us have to pay attention to.
Right.
I think we all do. I mean, yeah. And I always say it's that time when you do something that you go, you know, you do something, what we say, stupid, you know, and then how you speak to yourself after that, like, I can't believe I did that. Oh my gosh. I'm
such an idiot. Right.
Rephrasing things, like teaching kids when they say I'm anxious or I'm stressed, if you could rephrase it and not own it that way and say, you know, stress is here. Anxiety is here, knowing, giving it a temporary, not labeling yourself with that and trying to think about that. And I try and give those tools to kids and, you know, whether or not that sticks, but just something that even if they just catch it for a second, that's the minute you start something new, like you have a new pattern, that's when the plasticity happens, you know, and then trying to teach them about sleep, which is so hard during adolescence to get them to sleep, because that's the beauty of that's when the plasticity really, you know,
happens.
You get that cement in there.
I think that type of education, you know, how the brain works and mindfulness and making right choices belongs in elementary school, everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we spent more money and effort there, we would have less addiction in the country, period.
I agree. Agree wholeheartedly. And it's something that one of the things that is hard for me, there are institutional review boards. Like when you want to go and get this program into a metro school, you know, system,
yeah,
that a lot of times the institutional review boards that say, yes, you can go ahead and do this. Because if you want to collect evidence-based practice to show that, this is working, you have to go through the review board first and all that. And a lot of times they will say, you cannot put this into the curriculum because it's not talked about yet. And it's like, well, this is why we want to get it into the curriculum, right?
Right.
And it just is backwards to me that we can't do that. So it's trying to find out how do we change that?
Right. And I did a couple podcasts with blueprints. That's one of the ways of certifying programs. And the scrutiny that they have to go through to get approval of, you know, double blind placebo control trials that this education works long term. And yet still there's like 100 programs that have this, you know, blue ribbon certificate. I may get the name of it wrong. But there's no scrutiny for the Delta products and the psychedelics and like, hey, let's try this program. And the onus on proving prevention is so much more rigorous than the other way. I think it's amazing. And not keeping up with the times.
Correct. And yeah. there really needs to be, I feel education is, there's so much power in education. Right. And our kids can get it. That's what I know. Our kids can get it and they want it.
And they are getting it. And they are getting it. That's becoming the social norm, actually.
Yes.
Is there a difference when you talk to elementary, middle school, high school, and college age kids?
Yes, there is. Speaking to elementary school and middle school kids, we bring in different ways to do it. We actually have a couple videos that we're just finishing now, but they're kind of funny. You know, they've got kind of the Bill Nye the Science Guy, who is teaching about, you know, neuroplasticity and the kids love them. They love them. And so what we want to do with these is we'll send the video and then actually follow it with a lesson with the entire auditorium and talk about it. And as soon as they see, you know, the person who plays Dr. Alistair Pemberton Speck, when he comes in, they just come unglued because he's so good. So I think a little bit of, you know, just keeping them entertained, but making it so they can grasp it. We also have a game that we've developed. It's called Just the Facts, and it is a kind of Family Feud, Jeopardy style game.
Yeah.
And that was a huge hit. And it really is where the kids get these fact sheets beforehand, and it's all from scientific journals, you know, very highly reputable journals. And we make these fact sheets for them. They can either bring them home the night before, or they get 20 minutes to learn them before the game starts. And then once the game starts, they have to put the backpack or their sheet in their backpacks, so they can't have them anywhere around. Split the classroom into two, and then we have buzzers on the front of the room. And then one by one, they come up and face off. And it's like a PowerPoint that's behind that asks these questions. And it's made for teachers too, so we don't have to be present. Mm-hmm. Teachers can have all of it and do it, and then it gives the answer. The teacher can read, you know, what's below. But these kids are so competitive, and they learn it. And not only that, like in between the times I've been there, they will ask more questions. They'll ask fifth graders, you know, they'll ask questions about some of the concepts that we're going over, like nicotine. They didn't know. They thought that nicotine was just in cigarettes. They didn't know it was in vape pens. They didn't know, you know, like asking these things. And it was great. It was great. So we're trying to develop one because we did it for middle school and for high school. And so now we want to do one that's for elementary school for kids, because it's the one way is just to make it fun and, but they learn it, and the teachers and the counselors and their parents. I know some of the parents that were at this school, they actually reached out and said, my child was telling me all this stuff at dinner that I didn't even know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now, is this material available?
We are building this program, and it's on our website. The Just the Facts game, we're just putting that up now, but we do have on our website for, it's Speaking Through Me. at yes, at the Warren Center. And we want, that's our big thing. The documentary's there, the small videos are there. We want to make it just available to everyone. And, right. and that's why
we have that in the show notes. We'll share with the audience so they can go to that.
That's great.
Wow. And it's free. Is it, you know, if I wanted to play the facts game with the kids, I can do that.
Yes.
That is awesome. What about college kids? College kids feel like, you know, they know everything. That's a first time they're free out of the house. Sometimes the first time using drugs or alcohol, especially since they're 21 and they're allowed to do it now, even if their brain's not done growing. How do you reach that age group?
My my son's story really hits them hard, and I don't do it in a scare tactic, but just telling his story and relating to, I mean, he was just like them, you know, he was just like them, and they see his photo and see that he was just like them. And again, talking about the brain, that's when you, and I can be, you know, more advanced with it. And mm-hmm. and talk to them what's actually going on, and explain again an addiction, talking about family history of addiction, and but mainly what I do is I really focus on their emotional brain, because during, even though they're free from their parents, there's a lot of anxiety there, and a lot of people who are struggling in college, maybe it's the first time they're alone and whatever it might be, but really trying to communicate them about their emotional brain and the importance of getting help, talking to people, mindfulness, learning breathing techniques, things like that to help relieve stress. Those are the ways that they tend to, they listen a little bit more, just being really, because it's a very stressful time, right? Our college was stressful.
Yeah, it is. And it'd be good to have these, that's why I'm saying go younger, to learn these type of skills. It's emotional resiliency skills. Like, life is hard. So you have to have the skills to deal with that, so you don't go to drugs to deal with that instead.
That's exactly right. And I try to tell them that, you know, we always think of life as being kind of, there's good and there's bad, you know, we're happy, we're sad, whatever it is. But to try and look at it as, you know, those hard times, it's really, we're uncomfortable. It's being uncomfortable, and versus the, you know, the good times, we're comfortable. And it's like, I tell them the win of everything is learning how you get from the uncomfortable to the comfortable. Because when you get that, you learn that, you have grown. You've grown. You've learned something, how to get through that, you know, from going from uncomfortable to comfortable. And that's what life is. It's just that, you know.
I think we need that in every school at a young age, and, you know, with even little reminders, you know, like as part of PE, you know.
Exactly.
And mental education, right? We just need that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, talking about your documentary, Speaking Through Me. There's so much in there. You have the cartoons about the brain and neuroplasticity. You talk about mindfulness and compassion. And maybe we could share with the audience a little clip, because you present people who've suffered and how they've changed. And Lainey used heroin at age 15 and 28. And maybe we could show the audience that little snippet of her of explaining in a really beautiful way of how she became addicted and what that felt like.
My name is Lainey, and I'm in recovery from heroin. So I started using when I was 15. I am 28 now, so a little over 10 years. I wanted to escape what I was feeling inside. I didn't want to feel what I felt, and I didn't want to be me. So the first time it was, of course, with alcohol, and I wanted to be enough. And when I put that drink in my body and I waited a little bit, it made that feeling of not being enough, it completely went away. And every day from then on, I chased that feeling. It actually became the heroin addiction, the pill addiction. I remember I was driving down the road, like, I'm a 26-year-old heroin addict. Like, this is who I'm gonna be for the rest of my life. But once you finally own it and it's your identity, I think that's the darkest I've ever felt.
Yeah, she's my hero. She's my hero. And what she's been through, and now she's in recovery. And we're actually speaking. I'm speaking at the RX Summit, and she's part of the group that we're speaking with, which will be wonderful for her to share her story.
Yeah.
And talk. But she had a child and was in active addiction then, and got kicked out of the house until she cleaned herself up and was able to come back. And now she has beautiful family. Her son is Lincoln, is just a doll. And yeah, I'm so happy for her. I think she's almost 4 years in in recovery now.
How did you meet Lainey?
When I was making the film, I wanted young people, and someone I knew of her and said, you have to interview this young woman. She's remarkable. And that's how connected me with her. And yeah, I was so grateful, and we've become just wonderful friends. And I've spoken a lot she speaks a lot at Celebrate Recovery. And so I've gone out there and have this whole new group of friends out there that are wonderful.
That's great. And now I want to share with the audience the second snippet of Lainey, where she shows hope. She's, again, like you said, gone through so much. She must have had so much trauma in her life to start hard drugs at such a young age. She even like hints at prostitution in order to pay for drugs, and made that like just hate herself. And I just want to see the reverse. I want to share with the audience what she's like today.
I didn't start it knowing I would be selling my body for the next hit, leaving my child with me while I'm getting high. Nobody thinks about that. So it takes a village around us to raise us up, to show us like love and grace and mercy. And I think that's the important thing. Like, if you're struggling, talk about it. I love who I am today. There is a way out of it. You don't have to hit your bottom. You can stop digging today.
It's okay to not be okay, but you need to reach out for help to feel better. I promise you that whatever you're dealing with right now, there are people who can help you. Your life matters. Your life matters to your family, to your friends and loved ones. Trust me here. There are so many people who would be devastated not to be able to physically talk to you or hug you ever again. You deserve to love yourself. You deserve to be loved by others. You deserve to be happy, and you deserve to live a long and full life.
That's really inspiring. I just watched that for her and how she completely transformed her life. And I'm thinking, this is important not just for people who have a substance use disorder, right? This is true for depression or anxiety or just good life skills. That's why I keep saying that we need that education at elementary, school and throughout school a little bit, because it's applicable to everybody. It's a universal thing that and skills that we should have.
And I think understanding that it's just that same plasticity, right? It really is just stopping and making that decision. You have the choice. You make that decision. I'm stopping and literally, rewiring your brain to a whole different person. I mean, and that is, it's the one thing that it really is. It's such a difficult disease. It is such a difficult disease. And the brain changes drastically during substance use disorder. And people who recover from that are my heroes, because it is so difficult. And you want to talk about being in the uncomfortable, but they learn. That's the part that to watch them, whether they're going through the 12-step program, whatever it might be, Celebrate Recovery, to watch them every day, that they are rewriting their story and their brain. And it's just what that takes is phenomenal to me.
Right.
The power and the strength and the courage and especially in the adversity of how people always look at people who struggle with substance use disorder and all of that. Just remarkable people who are in recovery and people who suffer from addiction. Most people we know, even including my son, had a lot of empathy, had a lot of a feeling person, felt deeply about others. And I think that that's true of a lot of people who struggle with addiction. They are people who care too much sometimes. And I think it's hard. Life is hard. And that's where, again, teaching kids to learn with the uncomfortable, how you get to the comfortable. And it is that realizing that that is part of life. It's part of life. We all have it. Everybody has it.
Right.
And just hold on. That's the big thing I always want to just hold on. Whatever you're going through, it's going to change. It's going to change. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, those are heroes, but I think people like you are my hero. I mean, parents who struggled and you have the power of being a mom who's been affected, plus the added benefit of being a scientist and a chemist, that just adds to it. And you're using that to make things better. So people like you are my moral compass. And just share with the audience again how to access your things. Speak Through Me. How do find all your material?
Speaking Through Me. And if you can go through the website, it's actually Speaking Through Me. Squarespace.com. I'll have to put the link on there too, because it's kind of a long, but they can access, it has all the information regarding the program through Vanderbilt and the Warren Center and the documentary. It has resources for people who may be struggling with whatever, from addiction, mental health issues, or anorexia, bulimia, anything like that, that is, they need help with. So I'm just so grateful. I'm so grateful that you were able to have me here and to hear. I'm just thankful for what you do. Very, very grateful.
I'm grateful to you. We want to promote your information and spread. Again, I think it should be in every single school in America. This is part of the curriculum. You, the memory of Anders is a blessing through you and what you do and the socks you're wearing.
Yeah, I wish I could show them to you. They are quite, like, literally one of them, they're unmatching, as I said, and one of them has two giant holes in the bottom of the foot.
But it means a lot. And that energy is going from your feet to your brain and out to the camera. I feel it. So exactly, thank you. Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Physicians for Healthy Communities. Visit physiciansforhealthycommunities.org and view their video and resource library. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more high truths.